All right, we just took a test, right?
Yes.
So we're starting a new unit. This unit, the three chapters in one way or another are about metabolism and energy. Those are the two big themes. And this first chapter is a general overview of metabolism. Let's first remind ourselves what the definition of that is. What is metabolism?
Exchanging materials.
No, it's not. I mean, no. Well, yes, there are chemical reactions, but that's not enough of a definition. What did you say? No, the metabolism is the combination or the sum of all the chemical reactions occurring in an individual organism, whether it's in many cells or in just one cell, how big the organism is, in other words. And really, metabolism is what we call life. That's really, something is alive if it has metabolism. A dead organism is still an organism, but it's no longer metabolizing. Well, in this opening slide, we can see some reactions. This is not a single reaction, though. And that's one important point of this slide, is that there are thousands of different chemical reactions that make up metabolism. But very few, if any, of those chemical reactions occur in isolation, just by themselves as a single reaction. Effectively, all of the biochemical reactions that make up metabolism are just part of what we see schematized here, which is a biochemical pathway. Reactions don't occur in isolation. They occur as part of some biochemical pathway. This is just a generic representation of a biochemical pathway. There's nothing special about how long this is, but what makes a pathway is that it's not a single reaction. In other words, it's not just one change from a reactant to product. Instead, it's some number of individual reactions that are daisy chain, meaning that the first reaction turns whatever A, represented by A here, into whatever product B, and then the second reaction of the pathway uses B as its input, as its reactant, and turns that into another product, which then feeds the next reaction, and so on. It can be longer than what you see here, but a pathway is at least two, and typically more, reactions situated end to end. So it's a stepwise transition between the starting substance, whatever it is, represented by A here, to finally some end product, D in here, whatever that is. Another important point of this slide, though, is that for any given biochemical reaction, the individual reactions that make up, I mean, for any individual biochemical pathway, the individual reactions that make up that pathway are catalyzed reactions, which is why you see enzymes written above the arrows. Go ahead. Well, there is no name of this reaction. I'm saying that it's a catalyzed reaction, meaning that it gets helped. Where the hell are my pens? Oh. Gets helped by a catalyst. So the catalyst is the thing, catalyze is the verb. Each of these reactions is catalyzed by its own enzyme. Enzymes are catalysts. Catalyst is the more general term. It's a term from chemistry. A catalyst is some substance that is not a reactant in the reaction, and therefore does not get turned into anything else. It doesn't get turned into a product because it's not a reactant. A catalyst is a substance that, in one way or another, allows the actual reactant, whatever it is, to get turned into the product a lot quicker than it would happen without the help of the catalyst. So, in other words, catalysts speed up chemical reactions. Pretty drastically, too. Usually it's at least millions of times faster, the reaction, if the catalyst is present, than if it's not there. So that's just the general word catalyst. And since it's not a reactant, that means it doesn't get transformed into anything else. And therefore, once it does its job of speeding up the reaction, if there's still more reactant, the catalyst can keep being used over and over. It's reusable.
So like a chaperone protein be a catalyst?
Well, only if it's acting as an enzyme. A chaperone protein is... I actually don't know whether there are specific enzyme parts to that. There might be. I just don't know enough about that particular example. But just outside of biology, a good example of a catalyst is the platinum in a catalytic converter that gets stolen out of cars. Thieves get underneath the vehicle and saw them out because platinum is worth more than gold. So that's why they're expensive to replace. But the platinum doesn't get depleted. It keeps working as a catalyst to convert nasty stuff in the exhaust to slightly less nasty stuff, which is why it's illegal not to have them. Well, in biology, the catalysts that cells use to speed up their reactions are, in almost all cases, proteins. I'll mention an exception to that a little bit later, but almost all biological catalysts are proteins, and when they're proteins, we call those biological catalysts enzymes. All enzymes are proteins acting as catalysts. Now, another important part of this slide, though, is that each individual reaction has its own enzyme. And the reason, by the way, that when you put an enzyme in a chemical reaction equation, you never put it to the left of the arrow or to the right of the arrow, but above or below it. The reason you do that is to indicate that it's an enzyme. It's not a reactant or a product. It doesn't get changed. It just helps out. But the important point I'm saying here, when I got distracted there, is that each individual reaction features its own enzyme that helps that particular reaction out, but doesn't work on other kinds of reactions. Go ahead.
So in this example, the same enzyme for the same reaction, would that also be the same enzyme that transforms the starting molecule?
That's all enzyme 1 is able to do. This is the point I'm trying to make. Enzyme 1 can only help A become B. It can't help B become C. That's a separate reaction catalyzed by a different enzyme. A different shaped protein does that job. And this is an important point because it might seem easier if you had one master enzyme in your body or any individual's body, because then it could function for all reactions. But that would be disastrous. That would cause death, because that would mean all of your possible chemical reactions would be happening all at once, because the enzyme would speed everything up, making it all happen. You never want all of your possible reactions to be occurring at the same time. You want to turn some off and turn the appropriate ones on at the moment, and then later you turn the others on and turn these off. Well, you can do that by turning enzymes on and off, because yet another important point is that a catalyzed reaction never absolutely requires a catalyst. A catalyst is not necessary for a reaction to occur. It just speeds it up. Well, in biology, without the help of the enzymes, which are the catalysts, the reactions, even though they might eventually happen so slowly that they're effectively turned off. They're too slow for an organism to remain alive. And therefore, if you can control an enzyme, turn it on or off, that effectively allows you to turn reactions on or off. And since reactions are parts of biochemical pathways, that means you can turn entire pathways on or off. All right, and we'll look at all of that. But that's why you have individual enzymes for each reaction. And this is why, of your thousands of different kinds of proteins that you as an individual are able to make, out of the almost infinite number of possible proteins that could be made, you're only able to make some number of thousands, 20,000 roughly. The reason you're only able to make those is because you have genes for those. The genes are the instructions for how to build proteins. Well, a big fraction of that, in other words, a big fraction of your total number of genes, is dedicated to telling the cell specifically not how to make just proteins, but enzymes. A lot of your proteins are enzymes because there are so many different kinds of chemical reactions that have to be controlled. Out of slide two, let's talk about energy. Or let's start talking about energy. We'll be talking about energy for this whole unit, pretty much. There are a lot of different forms of energy, like light energy and mechanical energy and chemical energy and so on. That's not really the focus of this slide. Regardless of the forms, there are two major categories of energy, which is this is trying to exemplify. Those two major categories are potential energy and kinetic energy. Now, potential, just as a non-scientific word, refers to something that can happen, right? Something has potential. Potential energy is often defined in textbooks as stored energy, meaning that it's energy that can be used, but at the moment it is not being used to do some sort of work. Kinetic energy, on the other hand, is often described in textbooks as energy of motion, meaning energy in motion, energy that is at the moment being used. And that motion is why it was called kinetic. Even though it's spelled with a K, it is the same root as in cinema, which means moving pictures. And there's kinetic art, art that moves, like mobiles that move around. Well, in the picture we can see not only that there's these two categories, but energy can readily and is always, more or less, being converted from potential to kinetic or from kinetic to potential form. For instance, you have the diving platform here with the stairs. Well, to get to the top of this platform, you have to use energy. Right? You don't just teleport up there. It's work to get up there. You have to use energy. You're converting kinetic energy into potential energy. The more you climb, the more you're investing your body with gravitational potential energy. Because the farther you can fall, the higher you climb, right? It's like moving some for. That's a gravitational gradient. For a diffusion gradient, a concentration gradient, it would be like pumping particles to stockpile them in one place, right? That climbing converts kinetic energy into potential energy. Then, if you intentionally jump or just fall off the platform, your body starts moving because of gravity. And that reconverts the potential energy that you stored in your body into kinetic energy of falling. Yeah, and by climbing and falling. That's just one example. All right, but that's the big difference between these two major categories of energy. In slide three, I want to introduce you to a couple laws of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics is important for much more than biology. It's a branch of science in general that is concerned with energy transactions. And we'll talk a lot about energy transactions in this unit. You can see on the slide that there are two laws of thermodynamics being listed here, but there's more than just two laws. In biology, though, these are the two that we really care about, so I'm not going to give you all. There are four laws of thermodynamics, actually, and it's reasonable to assume, since these are the first and second, that the four would be first, second, third, and fourth, but that's not true. They had the first and second formulated, and then they realized, we need something more basic, actually. So they didn't want to rename these, and they stuck the other one in front and called it the zeroth law. So the four are the zeroth, the first, the second, and the third. We care about the ones that are called first and second. The first law of thermodynamics is often stated as the law of conservation of energy. Conservation, in this sense, refers to the fact that energy can't be created or destroyed. So if you consider the universe, everything, there is a constant amount of energy overall. Despite the fact that energy can't be created or destroyed, it can and is readily transformed and transferred, which are two different things. Transferring energy refers to moving energy from one body to another. And here I don't necessarily mean anything living. Body just means object, a physical body. An easy to understand example would be the breaking of billiard balls. You're transferring the energy of the cue ball into the other balls when you hit the rack. That's transferring. Transformation of energy refers to changing it from one form to another. For instance, there's chemical energy in the prey animal that's being eaten by the predator, and that gets transformed into heat energy in the second picture. That's a transformation. So energy gets moved around from object to object, and it gets transformed from one form of energy to another within any given ecosystem. The second law of thermodynamics has to do with entropy. I don't know whether you've learned about entropy in any other courses, but one word definition or synonym would be disorder. Entropy is disorder. And one of the important things about the second law is that the disorder of the universe can only increase. Entropy is always increasing, which means that the universe as a whole is continuously becoming more and more disordered. Now, if you think back to the first day of the course, when we looked at, I think it was even slide one, but when we looked at the seven major things that living things share, one of those was a high degree of order. I think it was a picture of a flower. It's true, organisms are highly ordered. That doesn't violate the second law, though, because it's possible to make some little subset of the universe more ordered, like an organism, as long as the rest of the universe becomes even more disordered than the amount of order you put into that little corner. So overall, the whole universe gets more and more disordered. Now, another important consequence of the second law of thermodynamics is that in any given energy transaction, some of the available energy gets lost as heat. What I mean by lost as heat is that heat doesn't perform work. Energy transactions often are trying to accomplish some sort of work, like getting you down the road by burning gasoline in an internal combustion engine. Well, not even close to all of the chemical energy that's in that gasoline mixture goes into propelling you down the road. A lot of it is lost as heat, which is why in an internal combustion engine, you can't run it for very long unless it has a dedicated cooling system. It will just seize up because it'll get so hot. Another way of saying this is that there's no such thing as a perfectly efficient thermodynamic mechanism where you get all of the available energy to perform some work for you. You're always going to lose some as heat. There's nothing we can do about that. And so the biochemical reactions that make up metabolism are similar to burning gasoline in an engine in that sense. Nothing, you know, every little step is going to lose a little bit of energy as heat, which doesn't perform any work. All right, those are the two laws we care about in this course. Now, actually, before I start discussing four, so we're still technically on three, since I introduced you to thermodynamics as a science, let me define thermodynamic system, first of all. A thermodynamic system can be just about anything you want, as long as you say what it is. To make that more clear, let me say that there's the entire universe. Okay? That's the universe. And when you define a thermodynamic system, which could be an organism, it could be a soda bottle, it could be an individual chemical reaction, whatever. But when you do define a thermodynamic system, what you're really doing is subdividing the universe into two non-overlapping subsets. One of which is the system that you just defined. And then everything else is the other set, which collectively is called the surroundings. So defining a thermodynamic system separates the universe into system and surroundings. That's true for any given thermodynamic system, but there are categories of thermodynamic systems. Three major categories I'll give you, which are open systems, closed systems, and isolated systems. An open thermodynamic system is one that is able to exchange both matter and energy with the surroundings. A closed thermodynamic system is able to exchange energy with the surroundings, but it's not able to exchange matter. And an isolated system can't exchange either matter or energy with the surroundings. Well, there is actually no such thing as a real isolated system. That would be a separate universe, really, right? Can't be totally isolated. So it's really just a mental construct. It's just a concept. Matter going from the system to the surroundings or vice versa. Yeah. Right. Matter and energy can go in or out.
And then isolated can be one or the other?
No, neither.
Neither.
Yeah. Closed, it can, in a closed system, no matter exchanges, but energy does. So nothing's truly isolated, but you know, we sometimes try to get as close as we can to an isolated system. That's the rationale when you design a Dewar's flask or a probably better known to you as a thermos bottle. Right? It is closed because it's sealed off, no matter comes in or out. And it's designed in such a way that the energy transfer is minimized because it has it's evacuated, so there's no conduction, and it's shiny, so that there's no radiative exchange. But you can't eliminate energy exchange. And that's why, you know, you come back 3 weeks later, and it's going to have a different temperature. But if it were truly an isolated system, a thermos, you could put either cold or hot stuff in it, and it would stay that temperature forever, because there would be no exchange with the surroundings. Okay, we'll get back to these as they relate to biology in a little bit. But let's now go on to four and talk about free energy. Free energy is potential energy, and free energy is symbolized by capital G, which might not seem like it makes much sense, except that it does, since free energy is kind of a nickname. The proper phrase for it is Gibbs free energy. It's named after Gibbs. That's what the G stands for, of course. But we usually don't bother saying Gibbs free energy, especially when we're using the phrase a lot. So free energy is G. All right, that's the amount of energy available in a system. And that's why I say it's potential energy. This slide has three different systems represented by cartoons. One is this diving platform thing we already looked at. The middle one is a concentration gradient. And this third one is a chemical reaction in which a large complex molecule is broken into smaller ones, less complex ones. Those are all examples of systems, because like I said, a system can be anything you want, really. But each of these systems is undergoing a change, notice, from top to bottom. So it's the same system before, then after. Well, I said that G is free energy. That G is the free energy at the moment. It's the instantaneous value of the available energy in the system. So there's a G value before in each system, and then there's another G value after. In other words, each of these systems is undergoing a change in free energy. And so even though G, free energy, is important, in practice it's really not as important as change in G, which is delta G. Right? Delta G is not the instantaneous value of G at the moment. Delta G is what you'd expect delta G to be based on how you compute deltas, right? Delta G is G final minus G initial. Just like delta mass for your potatoes was calculated the same way. And the value, the magnitude, the number, in other words, of delta G is important, but also very important is the sign of delta G. Since it's defined as final minus initial, if the value of G in the system is lower in the after scenario than before, final G is lower than initial G, then final minus initial is going to give you what sign? It's going to give you a negative number. Knowing that delta G is negative just by itself without knowing how negative it is very valuable. Each of these example systems, these three shown here, has a negative delta G the way it's happening, the way it's happening downward. Now you can imagine it happening upward. But think of these three examples. That is not going to happen automatically, right? You can keep trying to fall upward, but you're going to fail. And if you already have diffusion occurring, as it has had here, you can wait as long as you want, and it's not going to go back to being concentrated on its own. And a bunch of small molecules aren't going to just randomly assort into a large complex molecule. Each of these upward changes would be positive G. So the sign, whether it's positive or negative, of delta G tells you a lot about a change in a system. Or a process, I should say, because a process says that something is changing. It tells you about spontaneity. A process can be spontaneous or non-spontaneous. But what does that mean? Well, spontaneous in this sense means that the process is able to happen on its own. And notice that's how I first introduced you to diffusion. You have a diffusion, a concentration gradient here, right? And diffusion can happen on its own, which is why it's defined as passive. The reason that it can happen on its own is because it has the energy already in the system. The energy for diffusion is the gradient itself, right? And similarly, this guy can fall without forcing himself to, because he's going to go down his gravitational gradient. So a negative delta G corresponds to a spontaneous reaction. I mean a spontaneous process. But usually in this... Well, let me just leave it at that. A positive delta G, on the other hand, corresponds to a non-spontaneous process, which can never happen on its own. Now back to spontaneous, which is negative delta G. Just because something is spontaneous and therefore can happen on its own doesn't mean it's going to anytime soon. And this is why we need enzymes as organisms. Because if you wait for a spontaneous reaction to actually occur on its own without the help of an enzyme, you'll be dead. So spontaneous doesn't say anything about the speed of a process. It just means it already has built-in energy to allow it to happen, and therefore it can happen. But non-spontaneous processes can only happen if they are forced to do that by something outside of the system. All right. For instance, you can undo diffusion by operating a pump as long as you supply energy from outside the system, like in the form of ATP, to force it back into a concentrated situation. Every one of these, this is a point I was just getting to, so I'm glad you brought that up. Every one of these systems is going down in free energy, right? Lower G values are associated with higher entropy. And also higher stability. The higher the entropy is, the higher the stability is. So the universe overall, I said, is becoming more and more disordered. That means it's becoming more and more stable. The little pockets of the universe that have low entropy and high order, like organisms, among other things, those are unstable situations. Well, high G value corresponds to instability. That's why each of these three example systems, in a sense, wants to go to the bottom situation. Because by lowering the G, it becomes more stable. You're much less likely to fall off of the surface of the earth than from something, a platform well above the surface, right? Similarly, diffusion, this is much more disordered and therefore more stable than it when they're all packed together. And the large complex molecule, think about this in terms of how freely the components can move. When you have them all hooked together, it's all one big thing. And it can move around in space. It has some freedom. But when you break it into chunks, each of those chunks can individually move around. So it has more freedom. It's more disordered and therefore more stable. Does all of that make sense? All right. Then let's go to 5. Talk about these graphs. What we're looking at here are two graphs that are opposites of each other in a sense, but the graphs are set up the same. So you have on the y-axis free energy, that's G, right? But remember, G is the free energy at the moment. So it's the y value of one bar, the y value of the other bar is a different G at a different time. All right. By the way, the progress of the reaction is just another way of saying time. Before the reaction occurs and after the reaction occurs. Each graph is a reaction, though. And as you know, in any reaction, some reactant gets turned into product. Some number of reactants get turned into some number of products. Well, there is a G, a total free energy, associated with the reactants in any chemical reaction, and there's also a G value for the products, whatever they are. In the top reaction, though, notice that this is a reaction in which the G value is higher for the reactants than it is for the products. And therefore, you get a negative number, right? G final is small minus G initial large. When you subtract large from small, you get a negative number. It's downhill, energetically speaking. Well, I told you that by the first law, energy can't be created or destroyed. So if free energy goes down, that energy has to go somewhere. It leaves the system. And that's why this is called an exergonic reaction. Ergon means energy. And exo means out of. So this is an exergonic reaction is one that releases energy because the delta G is negative. And notice that graphically, delta G is represented by the vertical distance between this G and this G. Okay? Just the opposite in this sense is a reaction in which the final G value, the G value of the products, is higher than the initial value, the G value of the reactants. In that case, you have big minus small, so it's going to be a positive number for delta G. A delta G reaction, a positive delta G reaction, like the blue one, is therefore termed endergonic, because the energy has to be put into the system in order to make it happen. It's never going to happen on its own. But it takes in energy and rather than releasing it. That's why energy is coming in here. Energy is leaving for the top one. Well, for all reactions, reactants are what you have initially. Products are what they get turned into. Okay, now, I want you to think about three different pairs of antonyms, which are opposite in meaning, right? Like large and small. We've already actually, over the course of a couple of lectures, talked about all three pairs. But one pair of antonyms is spontaneous and non-spontaneous. Another pair is exergonic and endergonic. And the third pair of opposites make up the two subsets of metabolism. Have I already told you what those are? Right. And that metabolism is all of the reactions, but it has two parts to it. Catabolism and anabolism. Oops. So let me quickly define these, since we've talked about the other ones a little bit more already. Notice that what's different about these words is the cat and the an, which are the same prefixes as in cation and anion. Cat is the same thing as in catheter. It means down. A catheter is a tube that lets down or drains a fluid. And it's the same roots that are in cathode and anode, the positive and negative ends of a battery, for instance. And there are such things as catadromous fish and anadromous fish that use the same prefixes. One of them swims upstream to spawn, the other one swims downstream to spawn. So these are opposite words, cat and an, opposite prefixes. Catabolism, remember cat means down. Catabolism is the part of metabolism in which larger, more complex things get broken into smaller, less complex things. So catabolism is breakdown of materials. Anabolism is just the opposite. Anabolism builds bigger, more complex things out of smaller, less complex things. So you can actually describe the same system, like a chemical reaction, using any of these three words, but you would choose the words to describe a different aspect of the system. For instance, if what you care about describing is whether or not that process is going to happen or can happen on its own, then you would be saying it's either spontaneous or non-spontaneous. That's the use of that word. Could be the same process, though, and if you care about describing what happens to the energy, in other words, is energy released or is it absorbed, then you would choose either exergonic or endergonic. Those words describe that aspect. And if you're interested in determining whether things are getting broken down or built up, then you would choose either catabolic or anabolic. By the way, anabolic steroids are called that because they build your body up. So there's these three pairs of opposite words, but one of each of the pairs corresponds with one of the others. What I mean by that specifically is that catabolic reactions, things that break bigger things into smaller, correspond to exergonic reactions. In other words, catabolic reactions release energy in addition to just breaking things down. And both of those correspond to spontaneous. So catabolic reactions are exergonic and spontaneous. All three of those go hand in hand. Well, all three of the opposites go hand in hand as well. Anabolic processes are endergonic, they require energy, and they are non-spontaneous. They never happen on their own, you have to force them to happen. And the reason that we can see that, let me temporarily go back to four, that a catabolic reaction is exergonic is because of what I was saying about this freedom of movement. When you break this big chunk into several, that's a decrease in G. Higher disorder, which means lower G. Higher stability, lower G value, though, and therefore a negative delta G, well, that's by definition exergonic.
So hydrolysis reaction.
That's right. In general, catabolic reactions are hydrolytic. Hydrolysis isn't the only way that you can have catabolism, but that's often it is. Hydrolysis, remember, is splitting things into smaller pieces. So hydrolysis is catabolic and exergonic because catabolism is exergonic.
And dehydration is the opposite.
That's right. It's anabolic and endergonic and non-spontaneous. Now, this brings up an important point for the unit. The reason that we eat, the reason that we take in fuels... Fuels are the energy-carrying compounds that are in our food. We first digest our food into small enough pieces to put into our cells, but then once they're small enough, those little pieces, like monosaccharides, can be used as fuels. Fuels are sources of energy that, when they're catabolized, like the glucose that gets broken down in the processes that we're going to talk about in this unit, that catabolic reaction is exergonic, and therefore energy is released. We do that for the purpose of storing some of that energy that gets released so that we can then use that stored energy to force the various anabolic processes that have to occur that are endergonic and that we therefore have to supply energy for. All right? But that's how all of these words go hand in hand. Let's go to 6. Here we're looking at, well, we're looking at an example of a textbook getting something wrong here. This top thing is noticed, labeled an isolated hydroelectric system. That's not right. This should have been closed hydroelectric system. Why is this not isolated based on the picture? Because of what? The system is this: is the two tanks and the turbine and the light bulb.
The light's emitting heat out.
Right, and light. The fact that we can see the light means that energy is leaving the system. So it's not isolated, it's closed. But anyway, this is a closed hydroelectric system, meaning that no matter goes in or out. So the amount of water here is constant. But at the initial time, notice that there is a gravitational gradient because the level of the water is higher in one tank than the other. Therefore, there's a potential for the water to fall downhill from one tank to the other. And since there's a way for it to do that, it does. That turns the turbine and creates electricity, and therefore the light bulb shines. But since it's a closed system, no change of water, no water coming in, no water leaving, and therefore eventually it's going to come to equilibrium where the level in the two vats is equal and there's therefore no more tendency for water to fall and the turbine stops running and the light goes out. Well, that light going out is a good analogy because that's kind of like death, a light going out. And that's an important point here as far as biology is concerned. No living organism can possibly be a closed thermodynamic system. All organisms are open thermodynamic systems because in order to remain alive, any organism, whether it's one cell or many, has to continuously exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. And thermodynamically speaking, coming to equilibrium for an organism would mean death. All right, so we are not closed. The open thermodynamic or hydroelectric system that's shown in the middle is a little bit closer to what an organism is. It's open because water's coming in and it's also being drained off at the same rate. Since it's leaving and entering at the same rate, that means the gradient, the difference in levels, remains the same all the time. Water's continuing to turn the turbine and the light stays on. So that's a better representation of an organism, but an even better one is shown in the bottom, which is a multi-step open system. The delta G for this is represented here by the difference in levels. In the middle one. Well, in the bottom, it's the same delta G. It's the same difference from initial to final. But instead of letting this falling of water to occur just in one step, it's allowed to happen a little bit at a time through many gradients. And this is a better description of what organisms are, because speaking of fuels, when we catabolize our fuels, which means we burn them, just like you were burning fuels in lab today, we don't do it in one step, because that would release all the energy at once, most of which would be heat. It would be explosive and dangerous. It would kill the cells. And it wouldn't give us a chance to capture some of that energy rather than wasting it as heat. So we don't do our chemical reactions as single steps. We do it as several individual steps that are connected end to end. In other words, as pathways. Each part of the pathway releases a little bit of energy, and it gives us a chance to capture it more usefully. As we'll see, we capture it into the form of ATP usually. Okay, well, speaking of ATP, in slide 7, if you didn't already know this is ATP, I've given it away. What does ATP stand for?
Adenosine triphosphate.
Right, adenosine triphosphate. And that's what we're looking at here. This is adenosine triphosphate. What is ATP an example of?
Potential energy.
Well, I mean, that we have learned about. I'm saying as an object, what is it? As a molecule, what is it an example of? That's not a matter. That's not an object. Well, let's look at what we have here. What is this pink thing? It's ribose, which is a pentose sugar connected to a nitrogenous base and also connected to a phosphate group. Therefore, it is what? It is a nucleotide, exactly. ATP is a nucleotide. And since the pentose sugar, the 5-carbon sugar, is specifically ribose, this is an RNA nucleotide. Remember that nucleotides are the monomers that can be strung together to form nucleic acids or polynucleotides. There's two major categories of polynucleotides, DNA and RNA. This is an RNA nucleotide. So it could be, one of its jobs is it could be just one of several monomers strung together to make an RNA. And that's an important job in itself. But ATP has a whole side job unrelated to being a ribonucleic acid. Just as a single nucleotide, it's useful for the purpose of storing energy temporarily for cells throughout life, not just your cells, all cells. All right, now, before I get off this fact that it's a nucleotide, remember that a nucleotide has three parts to it, right? A pentose sugar, a nitrogenous base, and a phosphate. At least one phosphate. That's why the word nucleotide is kind of ambiguous, because by a nucleotide you know that you have at least one phosphate, but you can't tell how many from the word. Well, do you remember what just, if you didn't have any phosphates and you had just the sugar connected to the nitrogenous base, what would that be called? It's a nucleoside with an S instead of a T. And that's why it's not ambiguous if instead of calling this a nucleotide, you call it a nucleoside triphosphate. Because the tri tells you exactly how many phosphates there are. Whereas the word nucleotide doesn't tell you how many at all. Okay? Well, any given nucleoside, which is a combination of a sugar and some nitrogenous base, gets its own name based on which nitrogenous base is used. In this particular nucleoside, it's ribose and adenine, and therefore that combination is called adenosine. If that existed just by itself, that would just be adenosine, a nucleoside. But when you hook 3-phosphates to adenosine, you get a nucleoside triphosphate, specifically called adenosine triphosphate. Okay. This is often by textbooks described as the energy currency of the cell. I was telling you that it stores energy temporarily to be put to use sometime later. And this is why it's called the energy currency, by comparison, by analogy with currency, money. It's a pretty good analogy because you put energy into whatever you do as your work. But no one really works directly for the things that they need in life, right? You don't have a job for housing that's good only for housing. You don't have a job just for food. Instead, the energy of your effort goes into earning money, the currency, which represents your effort. In a sense, it stores your energy. And then that money can be used to cause all kinds of other things to happen. You can buy a bunch of other things, right? It's versatile. It doesn't pay for just housing or just food. You can buy anything with it. So it's the middleman between your job and the things that you need. Similarly, ATP, by storing energy, is the energetic middleman between cellular processes that release energy, in other words, exergonic processes, and a whole bunch of endergonic processes that the cell has to cause to happen to remain alive, but none of them is going to happen unless they're forced to by supplying energy. All right? So ATP stores energy that's released from catabolic reactions, which can then be used to do some work. The reason that it stores energy is there's a lot of chemical energy in the bonds between the phosphate groups of an ATP molecule. Well, there's 3 phosphates on an ATP. And so it's an even better analogy than saying that it's the energy currency, like cash. It's even better to say that ATP is like a debit card. Because a debit card can have different balances, right? It can have a high balance, a low balance, no balance. And the reason that's a better analogy is because ATP is like a high balance card right after payday. You can do a lot with it because there's a lot of energy in it. But when you use the energy in an ATP, you have to release that energy by breaking a bond between phosphates. And so ATP's bond would be broken right here between this terminal phosphate and the next phosphate. That releases some, but not all of the energy it's storing. So that would be like spending some of the balance, but not all of it. And what you'd be left with, as you can just picture, is a nucleotide that only has 2 phosphates. In other words, a nucleoside diphosphate, which in this case would be adenosine diphosphate, and then a phosphate just on its own. Well, that ADP, adenosine diphosphate, still has usable energy in it, just not as much as ATP. And we can see that happening in slide 8. If we follow the arrow. This can happen in either direction, but the downward arrow is the spontaneous direction. Okay, so this ATP molecule on the top has already been created. It's storing in the phosphate-phosphate bonds some of the energy that used to be in a fuel molecule that the cell used for energy. Some of that energy was lost as heat, but some of it was stored in the form of ATP. The next moment, it's going to need that ATP to do something that requires energy, some endergonic process. And it does that by stripping the terminal phosphate, as I was saying. That leaves adenosine diphosphate, or ADP, and inorganic phosphate. I want to remind you that a P by itself is not phosphate. P by itself is a phosphorus atom. P with a circle is a phosphate group, and so all the oxygen atoms are still there. They're just not shown. Why do we call it inorganic phosphate? Why are these two organic phosphate and this one is inorganic?
Because there's no carbon attached to them.
Right. These ones don't have any carbon in the phosphates either, but they're attached to a carbon skeleton. So they're part of an organic compound. When you break this off, it's just phosphorus and oxygen. That's no carbon, so it's inorganic. And that's what the I subscript stands for. Now, how would you classify this reaction? What kind of reaction is this? It is hydrolysis, which is why water is listed here. Hydrolysis of ATP is what is used. Another word for it would be dephosphorylation of ATP. It's because you're removing a phosphate, just one of the three. All right, and that releases some of the energy that it's storing. Well, that's why energy is listed here on the bottom as an output as well. Now, how would you describe this process in terms of the other antonyms that we talked about?
Catabolic.
It's catabolic. What else?
Spontaneous.
And what else? Exergonic. It's releasing energy. So this will happen on its own, spontaneous. The reverse of this is possible, but it never happens on its own, right? You would have to force the reverse to happen. The reverse is how we make ATP to begin with. When we have the energy from the fuel that we burn, that energy goes into forcing this uphill, and we put a phosphate onto an ADP to recharge it. It's like putting a balance in the debit card account. Now you have ATP again. So it's continuously going back and forth, this nucleotide and the trillions of other copies that are in your body, between ATP and ADP. So I say it stores energy, but never for very long. As soon as an ATP molecule gets produced, it's pretty much used the next moment. Yes, ADP, as I was saying, still has a usable balance, and so you could take another phosphate off of it. That would turn the ADP into AMP, adenosine monophosphate. Plus, you'd have another inorganic phosphate on your hands. And that would be a pretty strong signal to the cell that the balance is low in the account. When you have a lot of AMP, then that tells the body, start ramping up production of more ATP. Burn fuels to make more ATP so we can get back to normal.
Why is the phosphorylation?
It happens because there's energy in the bond, chemical energy in the bond, that gets stored first when you produce it and then released when you dephosphorylate it or break it apart. Right. This is why it's a middleman. And in fact, I think, well, no, actually not quite. Slide 9 shows you how a cell can perform an endergonic process, which is never going to happen on its own. It can force an endergonic process to happen by coupling it with an exergonic process. That's what cells do in general. They force their endergonic processes to happen by coupling them to an exergonic process. And that often, even though that's not always, often involves ATP. So we have an endergonic reaction at the top. Glutamic acid is just one of the amino acids. When you hook it with ammonia, you form glutamine. That's a specific example. The example doesn't really matter. But notice that this has a delta G that is positive. That should tell you right away it's endergonic, even if it weren't labeled as endergonic. Positive delta G is endergonic. Glutamine is something the cell at the moment needs for whatever reason. So it needs to cause this endergonic reaction to happen. Of course, it's uphill energetically, so it's never going to happen on its own. That's what endergonic means, and non-spontaneous. Well, look at this second reaction. Glutamic acid and ATP can react in such a way that one of the phosphates gets taken off the ATP and put onto the glutamic acid. In other words, you have a phosphorylated glutamic acid and ADP left over. That phosphorylation of glutamic acid energizes it, makes it a higher energy version of glutamic acid. All right? So if you have one of these phosphorylated glutamic acids, then it can easily react with ammonia to form glutamine, and the phosphate now is on its own. The bottom shows you the balance sheet of coupling exergonic and endergonic reactions. The endergonic one here is the same exact one at the top. It's just instead of pictures, it's symbols. Right? Glutamic acid and ammonia become glutamine. Delta G is positive. Delta 3.4. ATP being hydrolyzed and dephosphorylated becomes ADP and inorganic phosphate. That has a delta G associated with it of negative 7.3. So when you couple the two, the overall combination as a defined as a new thermodynamic system has a delta G that is equal to the sum of those individual delta Gs. And in this case, that's negative 3.9. So it makes the overall coupling of the two systems exergonic and spontaneous, and therefore it will happen. All right. Now, notice that ATP has a negative delta G of negative 7.3. What if it had a delta G of negative 3.4, which is exactly what the endergonic one requires? What would happen? Well, would it happen? No, that would it to be a zero delta G. And would that cause it to happen? If ATP has exactly enough energy to drive this reaction, would it occur? Why? That's right. The second law of thermodynamics would not allow that. Any energy transaction, you're going to waste some energy as heat. So you have to have even more available than you need because you're going to waste some. Well, in this case, it's plenty more. So that's why it does happen. Now let's go to 10. When we talk about endergonic processes in cells, it usually means that there's some sort of work performed. Work requires energy, and there's two major categories of cellular work that are performed by ATP, as you see here. First of which is called transport work. That's what this book called it. But really, transport work is kind of ambiguous. Transport simply means moving things. In this case, what it's referring to is more properly called transmembrane transport, meaning the movement of something through a membrane against its gradient. Well, if I tell you that something is moving some sort of particle against its gradient through a membrane, What is that thing? What does it qualify as? An active transporter, which we also call a what?
Pump.
A pump, right. So ATP can power pumps for transmembrane transport. Pumps create and maintain gradients, which never lose track of the fact that gradients are forms of stored energy. So pumps spend energy, but they also store energy. They don't just waste it. The second major kind of cellular work is mechanical work, which we've already looked at before. This involves these motor proteins walking along microtubules carrying some sort of cargo to get it from one place in the cell to another within the same cell. Well, that's an expensive process, as it shouldn't surprise you. You can't move things around for free, right? Every individual step of the motor protein requires a fresh ATP to be used. And that's why there's just so many quadrillions of ATPs and ADPs in your body at any given moment, going back and forth between those two lines. I forgot to mention that aspect of the slide. So the ATP can be used for either of these kinds, but to do that, you have to dephosphorylate the ATP, and you're left with ADP and inorganic phosphate. Then you have to go back to fuel, the source of additional energy coming into your body, to get these two back together and turn it back into ATP, which can then be used to do more work. That's kind of shown in slide 11 as well. Well, go ahead. You can think of your body as, or in any individual organism, having a pool of adenosine nucleotides in three forms: adenosine monophosphate, diphosphate, and triphosphate. So they're all just part of the entire pool, but any given one of them is in one form or the other. AMP is always a vast minority of the total. Most of the transformations occur between ADP to ATP or ATP to ADP. In emergency situations, though, when you're not making ATP, you can still use the ADP, and then a greater and greater fraction of the total adenosine nucleotides becomes in the AMP form, and that's when it's a strong signal.
So, like, if somebody, like, for instance, lost a little bit and didn't have food, that's when their AMP would get higher.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, if you're not bringing in any more food and your AMP is building up, then the body is going to be forced to start eating yourself. Your muscles, proteins aren't usually used as fuels, aren't very often used as fuels. They're mostly structures, and most of your proteins are in your muscles by bulk. Well, then you start burning those instead, dismantling them first, and then burning the individual amino acids for fuel. That works for a while, but eventually, obviously, you have to eat. So this slide just summarizes the middleman aspect of ATP. Instead of cells, cells don't have the ability to use the energy released by catabolizing fuels directly to drive the anabolic processes. Instead, we have to take the energy that's released from catabolic processes, breaking down fuels, and store it in ATP form, which is versatile because it can be used to power any number of anabolic processes. So that's why it's the middleman. Catabolism provides the energy to produce the ATP, which can then be used to drive the endergonic processes that turns it back into ADP, which can then go back and get rephosphorylated if you burn more fuel to turn it back into ATP. All right, I'm out of time.